After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast on the Be Here Now Network with David Nichtern. My name is Michael Kammers, your host, sometimes podkick, and intro, outro, monologist. It's a pleasure to be here with you, and all of us at CSM sincerely hope this episode finds you as well as can be. And so, welcome to episode number 28, Dharma for Difficult Times with Stephen Cope. This episode is a tough one to nail down on the soundbite, so I'm going to set the table quickly and then we'll get right to what is a very compelling and far-ranging conversation between David and our guest, Stephen Cope, who happens to have been trained classically as a dancer, pianist, and psychotherapist, and yogi, and whom currently is a prolific author with an upcoming book entitled Dharma for Difficult Times. A book which this episode happens to be named after. However, spoiler alert, this podcast is much broader than that, so please release any expectations, and I apologize for setting up said expectation. So how about a little bio action for our guest? Stephen Cope is a best-selling author and scholar who specializes in the relationship between the Eastern contemplative traditions and Western depth psychology. Among his seminal works in this area are Yoga and the Quest for the True Self, The Wisdom of Yoga, and The Great Work of Your Life. And as previously stated, he has a book coming out in January 2022 on Hay House entitled Dharma in Difficult Times. For almost 30 years, Stephen has been scholar in residence at the renowned Kripalu Center, the largest center for the study and practice of yoga in the Western world. In addition to his role as scholar in residence, Stephen is the founder and former director of the Kripalu Institute for Extraordinary Living, one of the world's most influential research institutes examining the effects and mechanisms of yoga and meditation with a team of researchers from Harvard Medical School, University of Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and many more. Okay, that's enough for the intro. We've set the table. Now enjoy the meal. Episode number 28, Dharma for Difficult Times with David and Stephen Cope. Enjoy.
Okay. Yep. Welcome. I'm here today with Stephen Cope, who I've known for quite a long time, but intermittently. And we've always had a nice, friendly relationship through Kripalu and through the yoga scene. And he's going to fill us in a little bit on what he's been up to, which is what I'm curious is to catch up so we can all catch up together with Stephen Cope. Stephen, thanks for coming on to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast.
Great to be with you, David, and so nice to see you after what has been a few years, I think, since I've seen you. I saw you at Kripalu most recently.
Yeah. I like to say it's called Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck, Pick Two.
Pick Two?
Yeah.
Okay. I would say probably, as probably most people do, creativity and spirituality. But I'm not just making a buck. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the idea of it is, you know, can you whistle and chop wood at the same time in rhythm? So many people in our environment, you know, some have struggled with livelihood. Some have really thrived. Just the balance of those elements and energies in whatever order you want to talk about them. But I'd like to take a minute and we just started talking before we got on and about kind of how you frame your own existence.
Yeah.
How do you think of yourself? And you started talking. I said, wait a minute, let's get that onto the podcast.
Okay. So, I mean, David, I'm 72 years old, so I've had quite a bit of time to think about it. And increasingly, I see myself primarily as a writer. So writing really runs in my family. My grandfather was a writer. My mother was a poet. And I've always loved writing. And you know, you said earlier, pick one. And I think there is a way in life in which you do have to pick. You do have to pick one or maybe two. And I would say that writing is what really, really gets me up in the morning. Secondly,
is that literal? Do you write early in the morning?
I do. Not early, because I'm not an early riser, but I'm in my office right now and I show up here almost every day of the week at between 8 and 9 sometime. And yeah, I usually work all morning. I usually show up. I have a deal with myself, David, which is that I call it suit up and show up. That I will show up, and if I don't feel like writing, I don't have to, but I will show up here in the writing studio. And the truth is, usually I do feel like writing. I don't have the kind of blocks that I hear other writers talking about, thank God, and I hope I didn't just jinx myself, but I really enjoy it. So I usually write every morning, and it does get me up. And then the second thing I would say is a yogi. I love yoga, practice yoga. I love to learn about it. I love to incorporate it into my life. And by yoga, I mean kind of capital Y, not just postures, which I do, but of course, meditation and the rest of it, all, you know, the ethical practices and the whole thing. So that's second. Third is teaching. I also love to teach. And I think I'm a reasonably good teacher, but I'm also a very kind of anxious person. So teaching, I teach quite a bit with Sharon Salzberg, for example. So with Sharon, you put the quarter in and she teaches, right? With me, I think hard, I prepare, I get all my Dharma talks prepared. I'm a WASP, David. So we have a thing about being hosting people. And when you're hosting people, you better have plenty of food and be on your best behavior. So it's just so bred in that teaching is it's a challenge for me. It's a little bit of a sacrificial dharma for me. But
meaning that it doesn't roll off your back. It's something you have to kind of prepare for and lean into to feel comfortable being there.
I do. I have the sense that when there are 50 or 100 people in front of me, I want them to get something that's cogent and that I've prepared and thought through. And I actually get pleasure out of the preparation, but I'm kind of anxious enough as a person to, still have the remnants of that anxiety that everybody feels when you're in front of a room of people. But, you know, I've been at Kripalu now for 32 years, and I've been teaching for almost that time.
Wow.
And so I've learned how to manage it, basically, right? I reframe anxiety as excitement and all the stuff you're supposed to do.
Stephen, how did you get to Kripalu in the first place 32 years ago?
Yeah.
And for those who don't know, maybe just say a little bit about what Kripalu is. everybody might not know.
Absolutely. So Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health is in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, up in the beautiful Berkshires. And I'm pretty sure it's the largest residential yoga center in America. It's housed in a beautiful old, well, not beautiful, it's housed in an old Jesuit monastery. Right. And was founded in 1983 in outside Philadelphia and moved to Stockbridge subsequently. It hosts almost 50,000 people a year now in yoga and meditation retreats and
wow.
personal growth programs and dietary programs and so forth. We're a very large retreat center, and mm-hmm. and we have this building that the Jesuits laid out with lots of big rooms and small rooms that are like monk cells where people can stay. I was attracted to it when I was 40 years old. As I said, I'm 72 now. Mm-hmm. I went through a breakup with, I'm gay. I went through a breakup with my partner of 15 years, and it was brutal. It was tough on me, really tough on me. And I had started meditating. Actually, I started with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche back when did I start? 1974 in Boston.
Wow.
Dharma Datu was still downtown, I think, then.
Wow. Yeah.
Later moved to Newton, and I tracked with them all the way along. And so I came in through what I think was initially your Sangha, right?
Yeah, no doubt, yeah.
And that's, I don't know if you remember the Dharma Datu that was in Cambridge, but it was right around the corner from my house.
Oh.
So on the way home from graduate school every night, I'd walk past this house, the big glass wall, and there were 30 or 40 people sitting there, just sitting there every night. And I thought, what the heck are those people doing? I mean, I guess I knew it was meditation. So I went in, and the guy said, hey, join us, sit down, I'll train you afterwards. So I started going to Dharma Datu. And dude, I got so into it. This is where I've come to really truly believe in past lives, because there was some quality of recognition of the Dharma.
Mm.
I was so lit up by the Dharma, and now I was 30. I was 30 then. And I wanted to know everything about it. So I really dove in. I read everything that Chogyam Trungpa wrote and everything else I could get my hands on. And then when I had this big breakup, I thought, I'm going to take a year off and meditate. I'm going to take a year off and I'm going to plunge into this. And there were two possible
places. Stephen, a year off from what?
Oh, from my psychotherapy practice. So
okay, because you didn't mention it. So all that time you were being a psychotherapist.
That's right. And I was. I went to graduate school at Boston College. And
okay.
I became a psychotherapist. I had a very good practice in Boston, a group practice in suburban Boston. I was trained in psychoanalytic psychotherapy, and then when David and I broke up, I just needed. It was like a sea change in my life. It was a crossroads, and I needed to move away from doing psychotherapy. And plus, I was so into meditation at that point, and also yoga, and so I had two possibilities. One was the Christian Episcopal monastery in Cambridge, right next to Harvard, called the Society of St. John the Evangelist. And I had my name on a door there. I was going to become a monk, at least for a year.
Wow.
And then a buddy of mine, my dear friend Michael, said, hey, dude, those monks all get overweight. Like, you don't want that. Come to this place called Kripalu out in the Berkshires, and I think you'll see it as another opportunity or option. So I did. We went out for a weekend. It just so happened that Amrit Desai, the guru, was there
right.
that
weekend. He was there the weekend you went?
He was there that weekend.
Okay.
He was
yeah.
doing this special ceremony called Vandana. And so in Vandana, you walk on your knees up to the guru and he blesses you. And if you're lucky, you have a spiritual experience, which I didn't have, right? And I knew nothing about what was supposed to happen. So it was quite
authentic. Well, what did happen? What did happen, and why would you describe it as a spiritual experience?
Well, because I was struck with a profound experience of bliss and rapture that went on for days, or even mildly for weeks.
Uninterrupted or intermittent?
Uninterrupted for a while, but intermittent for those next 2 weeks. Everything was absolutely okay. I had this profound sense of well-being. And
okay, let's bookmark that, Stephen. I want to talk about that some more in a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah. What is bliss and what is rapture and what do they have to do with your current state of mind?
Right. If anything. So. So that was interesting, right? And I fell in love with Kripalu. I mean, back in those days, it was a true ashram, right?
So right.
There was ecstatic chanting every night. Everybody was there as a volunteer. So everybody was doing seva, which means selfless service.
Sure.
And the guru was there.
He lived there? Did Amrit Desai live there?
Yeah, he lived there. I arrived in 1989, and we bumped him out in 1994 when the whole scandal that's so predictable now erupted.
Yeah.
And then I decided to stay. That's a whole other story. I loved this community because it truly was a community, and decisions were made from group wisdom, and there was a lot of communal openness to, they were very open to learning from me about the more Western points of view about psychological growth, spiritual growth. And I had all that training in psychoanalytic theory. And so it was a really, really nice fit for me. So I stayed for a year, and then I never...
Stephen, what role did you have there at that point? Were you on the board? Were you a director of something or other?
No, dude. I was chopping vegetables with everybody else, and happy to do it. I was chopping vegetables and very happy. Mm-hmm. In those days, there was a program that you entered through. It was called Spiritual Lifestyle Training, and it was a month-long training in yoga and meditation. And at the end of it, if you chose to, you could take a role of some kind, usually lower on the echelon in the organization, and stay. You could join up, and I did, and because I was really fascinated by it, and so it wasn't long before I started kind of climbing the hierarchy into more roles of more responsibility, and within not more than a year or two was teaching and studying, and again that was 1989 going forward. And then when the guru exited unceremoniously in 1994, there was a group of us who never felt like we were there because of a guru. Mm-hmm. I never did. I never felt devoted to him, except that is an exceptional person in many ways, and exceptionally flawed, just like everybody else. Uh-huh. So I wasn't all that surprised when he turned out to have a little feet of clay going on there. And so I stayed, and a small group of us stayed and kind of rebuilt the organization, became a 501c3, became an educational organization, really focused on developing programming, really high quality programming in yoga and meditation and so forth. And I eventually founded a research institute that we had in Kripalu called the Institute for Extraordinary Living. We had an alliance with Harvard Medical School. With the head of our research program was Sadhguru Khalsa, who's probably the world's most important yoga researcher. He is at Harvard. We had researchers from all over the world working with us, and so I founded and directed that program for quite a few years. and got my hands into research. And because we decided, because when I arrived at Kripalu, yoga was still pretty fringe. It was still pretty fringe. And we decided that in order to make it more mainstream, we had to have the imprimatur of actual science. We had to really study, well, what are the real effects and causes and dosages and so all that stuff. So,
isn't that sort of what meditation's going through now?
Exactly what meditation has gone through. And meditation is way ahead of yoga in this. I mean, largely because of Jon Kabat-Zinn and MBSR. If you apply to NIH, National Institutes of Health, as we have for grants, you'll see that there are hundreds and hundreds of grants a year given to Buddhist meditators to examine the real effects of mindfulness. And
well, and not only that, but there's really, really significant investments going into you know, the mindfulness meditation companies at the moment. It's a big trend right now.
That's a really good point, David. And you'll know more about that than I do. I know my friend Sharon knows a good deal about that, but I'm beginning to see it show up in terms of apps and online resources and all of these new resources for...
Well, just to frame it out a little bit, Calm and Headspace, which are the two sort of largest apps, are valued in the neighborhood of $2 billion each.
God, I had no idea.
Isn't that interesting?
That's amazing.
And it's all online, you know, mostly dial in from your phone and get a guided meditation or you know, different approaches. But, you know, a lot of, so you know, I think you may or may not know, but I started a company in COVID called Dharma Moon, which is, you know, online meditation, virtual training. And we do teacher training programs and all kinds of things.
I only knew since you and I started chatting about this interview about it, and then I investigated, but that sounds so cool. So this is actually part of that larger structure.
Yeah, Dharma Moon is meant to be a platform. Our sort of premise is when the sun of Dharma shines, all that is reflected by the Dharma Moon in terms of culture, society, you know, everyday life should reflect that that clarity and that brilliance. So sometimes we say under the Dharma Moon, you know, what's going on under the Dharma Moon? And it includes music and art and culture. And, you know, it's very much spinning off from Trungpa Rinpoche's vision of, you know, a kind of more comprehensive approach towards what meditation and it overlapping into everyday life. So meditation, like we're going to be doing one meditation in comedy, meditation in sports, you know, how does it leak? Like you have been studying this stuff for 50 years and it's like, I didn't want to keep it in the balloon. I wanted it to leak out into the,
absolutely.
Into the whole culture. So that's what we're doing over there. And it's, but it is interesting that people are really, so our approach is just to lay that in there, is going deeper. That's the motto we're using now, because everybody's getting a taste of mindfulness and so forth. But for example, most people think that's mindfulness is the full palette of meditation technology, you know, and that's,
it's not even, they don't, right.
Yeah. There's not even a sense of going from shamatha to vipassana, you know, like just any kind of sense of discovery. It's all stabilizing, relaxing, focusing, concentrating, becoming more productive, becoming more efficient. You know, so I think there's a tremendous moment here where people are going to get turned on, and then some of them, that'll be enough. Some of them will skip away, and some will go, well, what's, you know, how do I go deeper into this? And it might even revive yoga at this point.
People
might go from mindfulness into yoga rather than the other way around, which is how it was for so long.
Exactly right. It no doubt will, because meditators very often eventually find yoga, even if that's wasn't there at the beginning, because it's such an allied science, if you will, to meditation. You know, in the domain you're talking about, I started to get interested in the research function because I'm a classical pianist, and
we got to talk about that stuff too.
I noticed that when I moved to Kripalu, it turns out that the building had been a Jesuit monastery, I think I said, and there were two grand pianos in the basement that the Jesuits couldn't get out. So I got there and I'm cutting vegetables during the day. And at night I'm sitting at the piano practicing.
Wow. And how cool is that?
Oh, dude, it was so cool. Yeah. And people would show up with other instruments and we'd jam in the basement and people would show up with their voice and it was completely spontaneous, right? So I started to notice that my concentration skills and the whole range of piano skills were profoundly enhanced when I was practicing a lot of yoga and meditation. So
yeah.
I remember picking up the score, the piano score for The Messiah once about this time of year. And I sat down and all of a sudden I could sight read stuff that I never could do before.
Whoa.
And it got me really interested about what is this? How is it that meditation training and yoga training spills over into this domain of my life? And is it true or did I just make this
up? Yeah. You know, Stephen, our last guest before you was Robin Ford. Don't know if you know him or not. He's a famous guitar player. He played with Joni Mitchell and Miles Davis.
Yeah.
You know, and he was also a student of Trungpa Rinpoche. And he said, music is my dharma.
Oh, absolutely.
And then he gave a definition of art, which he had imported from Trungpa Rinpoche, which is art is non-aggression.
Oh, I love that. I'm gonna write that down.
Yeah.
That's a Rinpoche quote?
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, dharma art was a big deal with him.
I know.
Calligraphy and flower arranging and dance and all kinds of things, theater. We're all part of the whole onset of him presenting the stuff in the West. And the whole idea was that that taking the egocentric structure out of the artist's, you know, setup of look at me, look what I'm doing, and, you know,
bingo.
And just immersing yourself in the work and then absence of aggression.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that. And I will tell you, David, we trained every summer in this program. We trained a group of highly adept musicians at Tanglewood Music Center. Kripal is right across the street from Tanglewood, which is the summer home of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And we made an alliance with the Tanglewood Music Center such that we took a cohort of 30 or 40 of their brilliant students who came for an 8-week program every summer and trained them in yoga and meditation parallel with their music training. And then we studied the effects and we discovered that 8 weeks or 10 weeks of the training that we were doing had a profound effect on their music performance. But why? Well, precisely what you just said. I used to teach them the Bhagavad Gita and I've written a lot about this, but you know, the four pillars of the Gita, discern your dharma, do it full out, let go of the fruits, that's number three, and turn it over to a higher power or whatever. So letting go of the fruits, letting go of the outcome, letting go of their grasping and craving for perfection,
right?
Which creates so much suffering for these young musicians.
Yeah.
At first, they were completely resistant to the idea of letting go of grasping to outcome. But eventually, even in 8 or 10 weeks, they saw the way in which grasping the outcome actually negatively affects performance. And they started being able to let go of it. And so there was this flowering of their practice.
Stephen.
Yeah.
Alert here.
Alert.
Has that been a book yet?
No. Although I did write about it in the book that's just coming out in January. I wrote a whole chapter on Marian Anderson and her concert at the Lincoln Memorial. And then I went into some of the studies about music that we did at Tanglewood. But no, it deserves to be a whole book. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, you know, and workshops for musicians, you know.
Absolutely.
Well, I know some people have done a little bit with that, but I haven't seen a lot of it.
Well, you know who's done it is Madeline Bruiser, right?
Sure. Yeah, who was, you know, a Sangha member from New York.
Exactly.
The Art of Practicing, she wrote.
Art of Practicing. And right. a friend of mine teaches at a local college where I do some classes for him every year with music majors. Madeline Bruiser comes in too. Uh-huh. And we talk about how to refashion your idea of what art is and music is along the lines of Dharma, non-aggression, letting go of outcome. And they eat it up. Oh my God, these kids, it's so freeing for them to be freed from the perfectionism that has dominated their careers.
Yeah.
And kept them in a box.
Like discipline and ease.
Discipline and ease.
You don't usually hear those two words in the same sentence.
No, usually. What is it in Barry? Tranquil and... Remember, Sharon always talks about this. Anyway, he's essentially... Oh, yeah. Tranquil and alert. That's what she...
Yeah, she's got a way with words, definitely.
Doesn't she? Yeah. It turns out there's the town motto of Barry, Massachusetts, where her retreat center is tranquil and alert, which is pretty much the whole game in Buddhism.
It's kind of shamatha and vipassana together.
Together, exactly. Right?
Which is really, that's the way we were taught, is that those two, what people commonly call mindfulness practice is really shamatha vipassana.
It's shamatha vipassana, right?
It's both, because it's not just the focus on the breath and the stabilizing, but it's also noticing without judgment what arises. I mean, the definition John Kabat-Zinn uses has those two elements in it. And I would just say that's, you know, classically that's shamatha vipassana. And what's interesting is mindfulness is neither of those, actually. Mindfulness, you're a little bit of a scholar, right? Smriti in Sanskrit, right?
Smriti, yeah.
And which means remembering, recollection.
Right. That's right, exactly.
And it's actually, in a way, a more subtle and nuanced quality. It's closer to more advanced teachings, in a way. You just remember where you are. You recollect, and then, like Dzogchen teaches, you recollect and then you disown. That's the cycle.
Well, you know, when I came up, and probably you too, mindfulness was kind of not a thing.
Yeah,
It was really shamatha vipassana that I learned, and I learned it first from Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Then I learned it again in a slightly different form at Barry from Sharon and Jack and Joseph. Then I learned it again from Goenka. And then along came this thing called mindfulness, which is, I've never been able to quite pin it down. It's a vehicle for beginners, maybe, to enter in.
It's digestible.
Yeah, it's digestible. Yeah.
And but if you look at the definition of it, they snuck in a little bit of the vipassana element by adding the idea. For example, pure shamatha, which Tibetan yogis will do for months on end, just focus on the breath out and in. Yeah. No sense of gap, no sense of larger awareness or noticing anything, just to focus on the breath. Right. But, you know, this is a very long debate in the Tibetan schools that the Gelugpas would say, why are you doing that practice? It's just going to turn you into a lizard or a pig. You know, they would call the Kagyu lineage pigs because they just sit and breathe.
Really?
You know, but that vipassana, which for them also includes the idea of adding contemplation, insight, assessing the quality of the experience in addition to just stabilizing the mind. So, you know, I think also they say if you just do pure shamatha, that there's you can go into jhana states, absorption states, and the mind just becomes kind of dull.
That's right. Well, you know, what's interesting about that, David, is that, so as you know, the yoga traditions have largely focused on concentration practice.
Mm-hmm.
And
and jhana states, right? Which brings us back to our bliss. We're going to get back to bliss. I want to talk about bliss when you have a minute.
We'll circle back to that. But that's what, you know, if you look at chanting, if you look at most of the techniques in yoga are actually about concentration and absorption. And so when I was living in this community, it was practicing almost entirely concentration practice. And we didn't name it quite like that, but that's what was going on. And there was honestly very little wisdom practice, very little reflection, very little looking at anicca, anatta, and dukkha at all. Mm-hmm. And so, and Freud was onto this. Freud's big critique of yoga was that it led to what he called an oceanic feeling. And what he meant by that was precisely bliss, rapture.
Jhana states, absorption states.
Jhana states, right.
Yeah.
And he said, this isn't healthy. This avoids the very thing he was interested in, which was really more investigation, right?
Wow.
And looking at patterns and how patterns arise in their etiology. And so we discovered that at Kripalu, which was you have a community like that based on absorption, but without any wisdom practice, you're going to bump into some landmines. And of course, we did it. Because there's a blindness that comes.
Oh, that's so beautifully stated. And of course, then if you look what happened with the community and with the teacher, if that's all that's happening is some kind of blessing rituals and empowerment of those absorption states, nobody really has clarity about any of the issues that might arise, and then they come up as a surprise.
Absolutely, and the trouble with jhana states and simply concentration practice is that when you come back from those, the mind isn't fundamentally changed, right? And this is precisely what the Buddha discovered under the rose apple tree when he was thinking, under the Bodhi tree when he was thinking about the rose apple tree and realized that essentially that concentration has got to be paired with wisdom. And then he developed that whole new thread, which if you read the Yoga Sutra, there's Vipassana is in there. Like the third book of the Yoga Sutra is so-called Vibhutipada, which means it's mostly about supernormal powers. But if you look closely, you'll see that it's bringing concentration to an examination of the whole realm of mind and matter, of mental states and perception and so forth. It's in there, but it wasn't really developed the way the Buddha developed it.
Yeah. Wow. It's we're sort of onto something which I think is a very current topic, and that whole idea of going deeper, because it's no secret, that our culture is oriented towards success of the individual, perceived as like opting in and maximizing the capacity of one person to achieve something that looks like success from that point of view. And that we are miserable as a culture at dissolving some of that and actually working with interdependent, kind of perception. And it's being kind of proven right now by what's happening in the country on so many levels, right, in the U.S.
So many levels. So if you have a wisdom practice, you're looking systematically at impermanence, you're looking at no self, and you're looking at dukkha. And you're going to see the radical extent to which we're interdependent. And, and the whole human mind is co-created in relationship with other minds. And so this delusion that we have about, remember the whole thing with Obama about you created that or you didn't create that. Remember he was talking about the way in which we're interdependent. There was a lot of reaction. Well, yes, I created that.
Yeah.
I created my own success.
Right.
This is something Sharon and I look at a lot when we teach together is looking at kind of carefully in the course of a retreat, the way in which we've been influenced and co-created by our interactions with others.
Yeah, I think this is maybe a sea change too. I'd love to hear your take on this in terms of the vehicle that brought these traditions to the West and then the interaction with this sort of Western culture seems to be producing a new animal, and the hierarchical and patriarchal structures don't seem. I don't think they're going to make it.
Yeah,
Any thoughts about that?
I don't know. No immediate associations to that, except that the pandemic has certainly broken down all kinds of structures. And, you know, David, we've seen, just to go back to Kripalu and respond to your question, what I noticed was that it's probably true that the introduction of a good deal of structure, structured teaching, tradition, and so forth was important in the early stages of formation and informing people's practice and minds. But what we've noticed at Kripalu, once we threw a lot of that out, right? Uh-huh. And now what we're seeing is what emerges after years of practice, and I'm very interested in this now since I'm 72, I'm interested in, well, what actually was the effect of 40 years of practice? Right? One of the things I see is that my peers have all taken practice and integrated it in their own idiosyncratic way and come out on the other side, usually having mastered some art or science or some form that isn't explicitly meditation or yoga.
Oh, yeah.
But that's why when I talk about writing, that's my form. Like I'm really interested in mastery of that. And it's kind of like the boat has crossed the river and now you don't need the boat anymore. But there's this way in which fruition, and I'm really interested in fruition right now, eventuates in mastery that goes beyond form in huge ways.
So, Stephen, I can't exactly explain this, but while you were just saying the last thing you were saying, your mother came into my mind.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. And here's what the formulation of it was. Is she on this shore or the other shore?
The other one.
Yeah, your mother was a sort of on the other shore kind of energy, right?
That's right. But yeah. Here's the thing with my mother is that she knew she was a poet from a young age, right? She started writing poetry in college and honestly wasn't very good. I mean, who cares about that really? But she fell prey to the critics and she fell prey to her own narcissism to a certain extent about how wounded she was by the criticism of her poetry. And she stopped writing until old age. And then she went back into it. She excavated it. She pulled it out. She started writing again. She published 3 books. At that point, she was ready to let go of what anybody else thought or didn't give, you know, a rat's ass about what anybody thought of her poetry. That was her voice, and she was going to have it. And I just love that. And by the end, she was blind and deaf. She was practically in what's the syndrome called? Cut-off syndrome. Anyway, in that state, she published several books of poetry. She wrote a family memoir, complete with pictures. She was blind.
Wow. How old was she when she passed away?
She died at 87. Uh-huh. But she was not leaving this life until she had spoken, right?
Right, right.
And I love her for that. That was just such a triumph after having been really having suffered at the hands of critics and thereby not really owning her own voice.
What a powerful memorial.
Yeah, totally.
And also sense of journey, because I know a lot of your books are you're writing about a sense of journey, aren't you? You're really going. Where does somebody start? What's their unique contribution? How are they going to manifest that? And boy, it sounds like your mom really crossed a river.
Well, it's interesting, David, because I wrote a chapter about this for my new book.
It didn't new book.
Yeah, it didn't get in the new book. It'll be in the next one. But
oh, okay.
I paired my mother with Sergei Rachmaninoff because when Rachmaninoff was a young man, he was a brilliant student at the Moscow Conservatory. Mm. He won all the medals. And mm-hmm. when he wrote his first symphony, or was it his first piano concerto? I guess it must have been his first piano concerto. It was absolutely panned by the critics. And it devastated him. And it devastated him. He went into a 3-year depression. And this was around the time when Sigmund Freud was out there doing psychoanalysis. It was very young as a science. But one of Sigmund Freud's students took Rachmaninoff on as a patient. And they did full-on psychoanalysis. And Rachmaninoff worked his way through his clinging to his aspiration to be loved and his aspiration to be valued. And he basically said, I'm just going to do my thing. I'm going to do my voice, right? And then he wrote the second piano concerto, which of course is one of the most brilliant things in Western music. And it was a huge triumph because he'd allowed himself to speak his own authentic, precisely idiosyncratic voice into the world.
Now that is a mother of a story.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, let's just start off like, you know, three guys walk into a bar. Rachmaninoff is a patient of Sigmund Freud's student. I'm not, you had me at hello on that one. Such a great way to start it.
It turns out that this guy, who had been trained by Freud, was also a musician. He was an amateur musician.
What was his name? Do you know his name?
I am blocking on it right now. It'll probably come to me.
We'll Google it later. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And so he loved Rachmaninoff for wrestling deeply with his own creativity and his own own voice. And so they often talked about music because this guy could intelligently. And there was a great scene later on after Rachmaninoff died when the gentleman who was his analyst, who was, I believe, Jewish, was in Israel for a big concert. And they were playing Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto. And at the end, he was asked to rise. And the conductor said, this was dedicated to this dude right here who got Rachmaninoff out of his depression. And
What a great story that is. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, I don't know if you remember this, but the Bullwinkle show, which was a cartoon show on television. But do you remember Mr. Peabody's Wayback Machine from Bullwinkle show?
Yes, I absolutely do. Yeah, Wayback.
Yeah, he and Sherman, who was a dog, would go back in time. And they would have been there when at that concert, you know, in an episode, you know, and I just love that premise of like, would I love to be a fly on the wall of something like that, you know?
So that in the yoga tradition, that would be cool. No, in Buddhism, the eight worldly winds. What are they? Praise and blame, fame and repute, and so forth.
Yeah,
that was what my mom got caught in. What Rachmaninoff got caught into fame and ill repute. And at the end of the story, of course, people went back and looked at his first either symphony or concerto and said that was really pretty good. It took a while for people to catch up with him. But
and then the second one was the monster.
The second one was fantastic. The famous one, right? The famous one that you will recognize even now, because Rachmaninoff was just a cornucopia of melody. I mean, melody is just sprung from this guy, right? And he went through a phase in Western music where he was looked down on, because he was such a melodist, and that was looked at as very outre, right?
Low rent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, Stephen. Okay, so you're a classically trained pianist, right? And at some point, I'm going to think you might have considered that as your career, right? You must have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're a classically trained yoga teacher.
Right.
Right. Okay. Yeah. you're an author.
Yep.
Did you ever compose music?
No, but you left one out, which I haven't told you about. I'm also a classically trained ballet dancer. I got into ballet. I went to Amherst College, which was all men when I went.
And right.
Its sister school, which is Smith, had a ballet program, and the woman I was dating was into ballet, and I got big time into ballet. And I was immediately drawn to the classical forms.
Right.
You mentioned classicism. I love classical forms. And so I joined a dance company, the Minnesota Dance Theater, which is a great, brilliant company in the Midwest. And I had a whole phase of, didn't last for many years, but the interesting thing for me was, what is it about classicism? I don't know. But,
well, and you're a psychotherapist, which would be the fifth one that we didn't reiterate.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is maybe became classical at a certain point. It didn't certainly didn't start that way. It was revolutionary when it started, right?
It was, but psychoanalysis is a classical tradition.
Now it is, right?
Now it is. And so it has.
And are you a psychoanalyst or a therapist?
I'm a therapist, but I studied psychoanalytic theory and used it in my practice. I've been practiced for 30 years now.
But you were a practicing psychotherapist before your, it's interesting, there was that moment you talked about, kind of your shift when you broke up with David, that your life went from being a psychotherapist to more relation to the spiritual practices.
Yeah.
And that was your shift moment, huh?
That was the shift moment. That was, honestly, that was the moment, and you probably know this, where there was so much suffering that the only thing to do was to pay attention to it and to dig into it and to understand it. And Buddhism gave me all of these handles for understanding suffering.
Right.
and you know, I told you, I didn't tell you I went to seminary. I went through Episcopal Divinity School at a certain point. And it's interesting that the Western religious traditions, there is some real spiritual training in there, but it's hard to get out of the current day church. So, for example, when I went to Episcopal Divinity School, it was mostly about theological. It was mostly about theology. Very little about practice, about meditation, about contemplation. Sure. So when I discovered Buddhism, I was like, oh my God, this is a cornucopia of actual practice that I can do to make myself feel better.
Well, and do you know why people say God bless you when you sneeze?
I don't, actually.
Because there's a gap and the devil could get in.
Oh, that's, man has, I'm sure.
So the idea of gap or non-conceptual mind would be probably touched in those traditions, maybe as some kind of mystical experience or, you know, transcending experience. But, you know, I don't know too many people other than the Buddhists who granularly experience that space.
Yeah. I mean,
and actually have created a whole universe on a head of a pin in that space, you know?
If you look deeply, you will find a number of Christian mystics, like the cloud of unknowing and
Eckhart, right.
who did, but, or even in our day, Thomas Merton, you know, who was a great writer. And finally,
you know, Trungpa Rinpoche met him, right?
I didn't know that. No.
That was a meeting of remarkable individuals that they actually had a conversation.
Was that when Merton went to the East, or was that when
Trungpa
came to the West?
I'm not sure where that happened, and that's another thing to Google, but I'm pretty sure that they actually had a moment, and he had a high regard for him. And, you know, it's interesting because Rinpoche was looking for people outside of the Buddhist world who manifested some of those same principles. Yep. He was very open to thinking how could that happen without that kind of formal training. And the funniest thing about it is if you go into any of the advanced Buddhist teachings, the lower trainings, even though they're foundational to being able to take it on, get in the way.
Really?
Well, I mean, think about the Heart Sutra.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, no form, no feeling, no perception, no consciousness, right. No eye, no ear, no nose. Everything what is basic, the whole Heart Sutra could be just said, like, remember everything I taught you? Forget about it.
Forget about it.
Forget about it.
That's right.
Don Corleone, you know, because it's saying that those things don't give you any kind of standing. So what is being pointed to, which in the Heart Sutra is sort of the notion of shunyata, emptiness, right, has to, in a sense, unbuckle, unseat those other things which give you more conceptual hardware to work with, more diagnostic capability, yeah. more understanding. So as you know, as you get sort of further, they in the like the Ati teachings, the Dzogchen teachings, they say sometimes even it's just like grunts, like wow. The profound utterance is like you know, it's just nothing to say that would take that conceptual mind onto more of a journey.
You know,
and they call it old dog.
Wow.
Ati teachers sometimes call a state of old dog, like there's nothing more to learn.
That's where Walt Whitman went, remember? Ah. I'm my barbaric yap over the whole world. See, this is really interesting because this is where you come out eventually, inexorably, into that space where you're exploring, you know, Keats called it negative capability, right? John Keats, the great English poet, called it, he said toward the end of his life, which only lasted 26 years, he entered this state where he was exploring, living in the mystery and living in the dark and living in the not knowing and writing from that space. He called it negative capability. And he wrote his last great six poems from that space and also wrote about that space, negative capability. And of course, his last poems were his greatest poems. He said to his girlfriend, Fanny, he said, these poems have killed me, because he brought everything he had into this poetry. And he was already dying of TB, but negative capability.
Well, Stephen, what's it like when you and Bob Thurman get together?
Oh, my God. I haven't been in a convo like this with him, but it would certainly be fun.
You know, it's in a very, you know, compressed period of time, you can, you know, travel the multiverse in a way that I think it would be. I mean, if I had to engineer like soiree or something like that, I would try to put the two of you together in a room and then come back 4 or 5 days later, you know.
Well, I hear about Bob a lot from Sharon, who works with him.
Sure.
He's written with him. And of course, he's been in Kripalu, but it's strangely, Kripalu in the day before COVID, when we were fully up and operating.
Right. Sure.
I mean, we were seeing 650 people a night.
And, yeah.
And you could have like, well, Bessel van der Kolk was in one room and Bob Thurman was over here.
Sure, sure.
Sharon was over here. And so I didn't always get to play with my peers,
right,
like you.
Right. We just pass in the hallways there.
In the hallways. I know. Yeah.
But now the word erudition comes up as, it's an erudite is an erudite word to begin with, which is kind of ironic, but you know, tracking you down, like if I were a hunter, you know, I'm not sure I'd know where to look.
Yeah.
I would go to the country called Erudicia, and I'd say, has anybody seen Stephen lately? And what is he up to now? That's what I'd want to know. So I'm going to just throw that to you. What are you up to now? Where you said you're interested in fruition. You have a new book coming out. Is that right?
Yeah, I have a new book coming out. I started a book, David, before COVID called The Dharma of Difficult Times. And I was interested in the way in which, I was going through a difficult time. Let's just put it right out there. I was going through a difficult time with and I don't want to go into detail, but with a major person in my professional life. And I thought, I'm going to write about this. So I started writing about it, and that's where Rachmaninoff came up. I wrote about Rachmaninoff, and I wrote about Ignatius Loyola, and I wrote about Darwin, and I wrote about Jean-Pierre de Caussade, who was a great 17th century mystic, by the way, who falls into that mystic category of Christians. And then COVID happened, and so much of the mask was ripped off of Western capitalism, and we began to be so much more conscious of structural racism and the urgent need for social justice. And I was touched by all that, and I decided I was going to rewrite the book and focus on that. So the new book is an examination of the way in which the Bhagavad Gita, the great scripture of Arjuna's self-odyssey right. toward self-realization, the way in which the Gita informs our struggle with xenophobia and racism and hatred of the other. So I track it from, I start with Gandhi, and then I move to Thoreau, and then I moved to Harriet Beecher Stowe, and then to a great Civil War hero who's unknown but brilliant, and then to Sojourner Truth, and then to Marian Anderson, and then to Martin Luther King, and then to a current day activist named Ruby Sales. So essentially, I track the effect of the Bhagavad Gita on this whole trajectory, starting in 1830 in Concord with Thoreau, all the way up to the present day in the Deep South in Alabama. This book kicked my butt, David. You cannot even believe
it. Is it finished?
Yeah, it's finished. It'll be out on January 11th.
Oh, good timing, because the podcast will come out right around then. So what's the name of it?
It's called The Dharma in Difficult Times.
Okay, and it's on Hay House?
It's on Hay House. It's with Hay House. Yep.
Right. Okay, everybody, be looking out for that.
Yeah, thanks, Tang.
I don't think times are going to get much easier between now and then, so I think you're still going to be good.
I think it landed, but it's interesting. I started it before the world fell apart, but then I got interested in, hey, the world has fallen apart many times.
Yes, it has.
In the last many, many centuries. And
each of our worlds has fallen apart many times.
Yeah, and falls apart every day.
And, yeah. But I have an idea for you. Let's reboot Peabody, Professor Peabody and Sherman. You'll be Professor Peabody.
Okay.
I'll play Sherman. I'm going to get these glasses on.
I love it.
What do you think? Okay.
Perfect.
Yeah. So and we'll visit these places. We'll do animated versions of ourselves.
Dude,
and you'll be leading the audience through me on these trips to see who was this person in the Civil War who was so influential. I'll ask some very innocent but, kind of provocative kind of questions, and then you'll have a chance to thread the whole thing together, and we'll do a Netflix series on it. What do you think?
I'm so totally in. The idea of you as Sherman throws me into paroxysms. I'm telling you right now. That's it.
Gee, Stephen, I didn't even know that I didn't even know Sigmund Freud had a dog.
That's so funny. Great. Well, you know what? It makes me think of Sharon's little thing where she's portrayed as a dog with a little purse. Have you seen that?
No.
Oh, okay. It's
Sharon Salzberg?
Yeah. It's absolutely adorable. And her voice comes out of this little dog. And
where is it? On her website?
Yeah, you can go on her website. You can find it. She appears in these different situations that cause suffering, and dog discovers mindfulness, and it's adorable. It really is.
Well, it must be a coming thing, because do you know who Duncan Trussell is? Bumped into? So Duncan, I've been doing my dual identity as a Dharma teacher and guitar player, I just was playing with Krishna Das at the Ram Das retreat in Maui. Yeah. I just got back on a red eye yesterday, actually. Uh-huh. And there is a younger, a gentleman who joined in that satsang named Duncan Trussell. And he's a podcaster and a comedian, and quite well known in his zone. And he has a very interesting group of, you know, he's sort of Captain Trips for a whole new generation in a way, and very brilliant and very lovely. And so we talk all the time about meditation and so forth. And he did a Netflix series called Midnight Gospel.
Okay.
And it is 8 episodes. And he also had his mom on it, which is sort of a reminiscent thing. On the last episode, and they were live podcasts with these people that they then animated. And in episode 6, I appeared as myself, a cartoon version of me, David, the meditation teacher. His character was an octopus.
Oh, my God. I love
it. He said, can you help me out here? And he was all tangled up in himself, and I just sort of helped unscramble him. So I think this idea of the animation is, Headspace uses that as part of their thing.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, there's some way for people to. What's interesting about your, I mean, it's just from my perspective, but your erudition is so deep, Stephen. Look, like I, you know, you're a world class erudite.
Well,
if it was Erudites Anonymous, I'd have to register you in it.
You end up there if you're looking for answers, because there's so many great minds who have delved into this territory from different kinds of, through different doorways. And that's what's fascinated me all along, really.
Wow. I think that's a self-portrait that is a pretty good note to end on.
Yeah.
That somehow you've tied together what could be taken to be very distinct disciplines. They could be. And you found a thread through it. So if now we're at the last moment and somebody says, Stephen, sum it up. What's the golden thread?
The thread is the human mind. I mean, it's the mind of everybody. In yoga, it's called samapati or coalescence, which means we're all made of the same stuff, and that's what joins us together. Coalescence.
And do you take it with you? Where does it go when your mortal body perishes? What happens to that coalescence?
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. We're already united. And when you leave this body, you simply join that at a deeper level.
Yeah. The subtle consciousness.
The subtle consciousness. That's right.
Well, Stephen, this was so much fun.
Totally fun, Dave. I knew it would. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, there's threads we could have, like, you know, we could go down the Brahmaputra or down the Ganges or down the Mississippi River, I'm sure, too. But I just want to thank you on behalf of all of our Dharma Moon community and the listeners who listen to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast. Everybody will post the link to Stephen's book on the site, so you'll have a shot at getting it and pre-ordering it. Is it up for pre-order now?
It is. Yeah, it's on Amazon. Yep.
Great. Okay. So hopefully we can have you back on at some point. And we're doing all kinds of webinars and things, you know, building that platform. Great. So definitely we'll get back together again sooner than this has been.
That's great, David. I'm so appreciative. This was totally fun.
We'd like to thank you for watching CSM. We'd like to thank you for tuning in again. And we'd like to thank everyone at Be Here Now, like Corey and JR, and anyone who helped somehow. And if you'd like to see more of David's interviews, you can tune in at www.BeHereNowNetwork.com/David. Thanks for watching, everybody. Just a couple quick announcements here at the end. Learning how to play the guitar. It's going to get better. That's not really the announcement. Rachmaninoff's therapist's name was Nikolai Dahl. The 8 worldly concerns, which were very briefly mentioned. Not all 8 were mentioned. There's a lot of lists in Buddhism. This one in particular really cuts right through, and it can be a challenging contemplation. But due to hope and fear, one could say, and our habitual attachment and aversion to these four pairs, we stay locked in cyclical bewilderment, also known as samsara. They are gain and loss, praise and blame, happiness and suffering, fame and insignificance. Good luck contemplating that. And the foundational practice in Buddhism to see these things clearly is the shamatha vipassana, which is also kind of called mindfulness meditation these days. And if you're interested in mindfulness meditation for youngsters, well, there's some very good news. A recent graduate of one of our mindfulness meditation teacher training programs, Debbie Nutley, has written and released a book called Penguin's Breath. Congratulations, Debbie. We're proud of you. And if anybody out there would like a gift of a book to help their children get into mindfulness, it's a good one to pick up. You can find it on the internet if you search Debbie Nutley, Penguin's Breath. And it's the story of a penguin. Baby, child penguin, finds the power of its breath to help it overcome obstacles. Also, we have an upcoming David's View episode, or a recording session. We're going to record a bunch of them. So if you have any questions that you'd like me to ask David, please shoot me an email at michaelk@dharmamoon.com or leave a comment on this video in the YouTubes, and I'll see it. And we'll talk to David about it very soon. Well, there you go, folks. That's our episode. We'd like to thank you for watching. May you be safe, healthy, and happy, and at ease. All the best.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/BeHereNow.